Hi, everybody. My name is Marcy White, and I'm still a recovering Al-Anon. I've been recovering a lot of years. Some are sicker than others. I love the theme of this conference, freedom. And I've been thinking about that. I wanted freedom all of my life. And when I was a child, I wanted to be free of what my parents wanted me to do. I wanted to be free of my alcoholic father. Then you know what I did? I married one, and I wanted to be free of that. And I always thought if I could just get free, I would be happy. And you know, the Al-Anon program has taught me to be free. And I found out it's an inside job, and it doesn't matter that much what they say or they do. It's all inside. And when we have the ability to have some answers in this program, then we're not in bondage anymore. I found that for me, that I was dependent as long as I didn't have answers. And when I had answers, then I could be free. But I also found out that if I had answers and remained dependent, then I was in bondage. My story goes back, way back, and I've asked God to put the words in my mouth and tell me what to say to you today, because there's no way I can talk about all of it. I fell in love and married an alcoholic. I did not know that he was an alcoholic, and I had said that I would never go with anyone that drank, and I would never drink because I didn't like what I saw at home. And it was not any time at all until I knew that we had a problem at home. I did not know that Bob was an alcoholic for years. I didn't know that. He had some people come and try to help him a few times. And I would remember what they said. He promptly forgot. And I would remind him sometimes of what they said. And sometimes he went on the wagon. And one time he came back from his parents' home, who were very devout Baptists. And they had sessions with him. And they would get on their knees and have prayer meetings. And it would just drive him up the wall. And he came back one time saying he wasn't going to drink anymore. And I met him at the airport. And I said, "That's just great. If you're not going to drink anymore, we'll have to change our friends." And he says, "Oh, no. Those people that don't drink bore me." But he said he was going on the wagon, and I encouraged him. And we went out to dinner to celebrate. And when dinner was over, he ordered a cream de menthe. And I said, "You said you were not drinking." He said, "This doesn't count." And he drank cream de menthe for about 3 months till his tongue was green and his socks were green. So you can see we had an interesting life together. After about 15 years of this, I had given up that we were ever going to be okay, that we'd ever have a marriage that would work. We had 3 children by this time, and I had had a couple of AAs. I guess they made a 12-step call on me. We were in Greeley, Colorado, and Bob was doing buying orders for an oil company. And he would carry his bottle wherever he went, and he'd have his bottle by the telephone. He'd have his bottle at the farmhouse. Wherever he was, he had his bottle. And these people were strangers, and I guess they knew more about my husband than I did myself, because they got me off to the corner one evening and asked me if I knew my husband was an alcoholic. And I really didn't want to admit that, and I wasn't real sure. Now, this is denial I'm telling you about. And I said, "Well, I know that he drinks too much. And I know that he's probably on the fence. And if he doesn't do something about it, he probably will become an alcoholic." Well, I got in Al-Anon, and I found out he'd been an alcoholic for 15 years. But I thought that alcoholics were skid row bums, and they slept under park benches or under bridges, and they didn't have homes. I had forgotten to look at the fact that we probably wouldn't have had one either if his father hadn't supplied me with the money to pay the rent. I just could not believe that what these people were telling me, and they told me some things that he would start doing if he didn't quit drinking. And they told me about blackouts and passing out and the reason that he hid his drinks. And I said, well, he doesn't need to hide his drinks. He keeps this bottle on the kitchen cabinet, and all I ever say is, don't drink so much. And they said that he would start sneaking drinks, hiding drinks, because he didn't want me to know how much he was drinking. He didn't even want to know himself how much he was drinking. So very shortly after I had my first encounter with people in AA, I saw that they were correct. And they also told me they'd send me some literature. And I remember going to the mailbox at least for a month looking for that literature, and I never got it. And I've never been able to find these people to tell them how much I appreciate what they did for me. Their names are Carl and Anna. And wherever you are, Carl and Anna, God bless you, and I thank you for making a 12-step call on me. At that time, Al-Anons did not go to AA unless, Al-Anons didn't go to Al-Anon or AA, either one, unless their husbands went. So my thinking was, well, I guess that I will just have to leave him because there's no help for him unless he will go, and he had refused to go. And I didn't think there was any help for me. I didn't know I could go. And I made the decision to leave and wrote his parents a letter and told them the truth instead of lying. I had always covered up his drinking from them because of their religious beliefs. They finally found him in Jackson, Mississippi, and Bob was a running drunk, and he would take off for the office or something and be gone maybe a week or two, sometimes 2 or 3 months. And we lived in Denver, Colorado, and he was in Jackson, Mississippi, been there 2 or 3 months. And he had not checked in with me, but in the drinking days, there's the grapevine too. And the grapevine news was that he wasn't down there working, that he was laying up in the hotel room drunk. And that helped me to make the decision that, and there really wasn't any money, and there just didn't seem to be anything to do but leave and try to start over. So, because of that, I wrote his mother and father a letter and told them the truth. And they found him in Jackson, Mississippi. Sent him a plane ticket, and he came home, to my utter amazement. Now, not home to me, home to them, because I had told them that I was through with him and they could have him back. I did not want him any longer. So they took it upon themselves to do something with him, and they took him to a psychiatrist in Dallas, Texas. And the psychiatrist said that he was suffering from the war years, and that's the reason he drank too much. All the trouble he'd had in the war and the prisoner of war camps and all that stuff. And the psychiatrist said that he would have to go to a mental institution for at least a year and a half before he could drink properly and associate in society again. I didn't know much, but I knew more than to believe that, just from my one encounter with these people. And when the family called and reported to me what was going on, I said, well, did the psychiatrist say anything about him being an alcoholic? And they said, oh, no, it's not that. It's just the terrible experiences that he's had. And I said, well, I believe he is one, and I believe you better look into that. Unbeknownst to me, now, I had left him, and I had also written him a letter to the home place where his parents were, and asked them to give him the letter. And I had told him, you know, that was it, and I was through, and I felt like that he would be in the mental institution just any day, and I was really relieved that I wouldn't have to worry about him anymore. I felt like in the last years of his drinking when we were together that I was a babysitter sitting with a baby giant. He was 6'2 and weighed 200 pounds, and I would have to watch him when he would pass out at night to take his cigarette out from between his fingers and put it out, because one time the bed caught on fire. And we just had lots of experiences like that, and I just felt like I was responsible for him. And I knew that I couldn't be responsible for him and babysit and go to work and have 3 children to be responsible for, too. So all of that helped me to make the decision that it was time to go. Unbeknownst to me, 3 men in Midland, Texas heard about Bob's predicament. And they made a 700-mile round trip to carry him the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. He never had another drink. They took him to Waco to his first meeting and stayed with him 2 days and three nights and told his family to take him back to meetings. That was 40 miles away. And the way Bob got to the program, he had nothing. He had no money. He was stripped of his pride, and his wife and children were gone. And that's what it took for him. And I did not realize for years in this program how tough that was, because I was so involved with myself and so self-centered and full of self-pity that I was not able to see what he was going through. After I had sold furniture that was hocked to gather up enough money to make a move home to my mother and father's house, I imagine that took about a month. And there wasn't anybody else that would have me or want me with three children except my mother and father, and I knew he was drunk. I knew what I was going home to, but there wasn't anything else to do. And I thought Bob was in the mental institution by this time. I'm just was sure he was. And the night I get to my mother's home, he calls me, and he's in Midland, and he wants to see me. I didn't want to see him. And the reason being that he could always con me into anything he wanted me to do, and I had made up my mind I wasn't going back to him, and I didn't want to get talked into it. But he conned me into letting him come out. And so he came, and to my utter amazement, he wasn't drinking. His face wasn't red and bloated. His eyes were clear. We sat down at the kitchen table to talk, and he told me that he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had been sober 6 weeks. And I couldn't believe it. He also told me that whatever I wanted to do, that he would help me. That if I wanted a divorce, he would help me get it. Now, I was not ready for this. I was ready for an argument. I was ready for all kinds of things, but I had never seen this person before. He was brand new, and I didn't know how to handle it. I could have fought, I could have argued, I could have cried, I could have done a lot of things, but I was in shock. His whole behavior was different. He told me that he had a job, and he had told me for 3 years that he couldn't get a job. He told me that he had money, and he offered me some money, which that was just unheard of. We always fought over money. He said, you have no business trying to live here with your mother and father with three children, and so get an apartment. And I did, and left him out. And the AA started coming to call. There were no Al-Anons. Al-Anon was not named then. This was in 1954. Al-Anon was the family wives group. And they didn't, I never saw any of the Al-Anons, but the AAs came. And they would tell me how well he was doing, and I would say, well, I'm certainly glad. He certainly needs to be doing better. And they would invite me to meetings, and I would say, no, thank you. Henry ended up to be Bob's sponsor, and Henry's the one that came the most. And Henry said, I was the hardest nut to crack he ever got a hold of. He said, AAs are nothing compared to you. I was determined that I was going to live my life and leave him out, and I was going to get on with it, and I had wasted enough time with him. But, you know, God does intervene, and thank God that he does. Some things happened that opened my mind just a little bit. We had twin daughters, Sharon and Susan. They were 8 years old. And they had been with their daddy on the farm when he was sober, and they loved their daddy, and they could not understand why he wasn't living with us. He was in the same town. And they asked me one day why Daddy wasn't living with us. And I got sort of nervous, and I didn't exactly know what to say. And I said, well, there's just not room for him. We have this little two-bedroom apartment, and Sandy and I sleep in one bed, and you two sleep in the other bed, and there is no place for him. And Susan looked up at me with tears in her eyes and said, Mother, I tell you what we'll do. If you'll let Daddy come and live with us, We'll sleep on the couch and let Daddy have our bed. And that did something to me. I knew how these children love their daddy, and I knew that I would be depriving them of an experience with their father sober. I did not have any idea that he would stay sober. And then Henry called me and asked me to dinner one night, and I had been feeling kind of bad because I had not been nice to Henry. I had not been nice to any of the AAs that came. So I thought, well, I will do that, and I accepted. And then Henry said, by the way, Bob's coming too. Is it okay if he picks you up? And I said, well, yes, we're speaking. That'll be all right. So I get there, and they had the white linen tablecloth on, and they had the crystal and the china and the silver out, and they impressed me. Now, I don't know why I still had so much false pride. And the only way I could get out of the state of Colorado was to sell furniture that was already hocked, you know. How could I have any false pride left? But I did. And it was necessary for this to happen for me, because my concept was that I won't have anything to do with you. You were all Skid Row bums, is what I thought. So here were these lovely women and these nice men, and they were all dressed up, and I was impressed. And I found that I was having a good time, too, and everybody was just chatting and laughing, and it was fun. After dinner, they said to me, by the way, we're all going to a meeting. Wouldn't you like to go? Well, that was the last thing I wanted to do, was go to a meeting. But I had spent most of my life conforming resentfully. So one more time, I conformed resentfully, and I went to the meeting. I liked what I saw, I liked what I heard, and I liked what I felt. And I realized at that first meeting, I don't have to lie anymore. I don't have to pretend. I don't have to cover up. I can be me. They've accepted Bob just like he is. They must know something about him and what he's done, and it's still okay. But I wasn't going back, because I wasn't going to let you all talk me in to taking him back. So I didn't go. And several weeks rocked on, and Bob called me and asked me if I would go to another meeting with him, and I did. And it was an open meeting, a small group. And after the meeting, he said, may I come up and talk? Now, it took me years before I figured out what he was doing. Now, today, I can tell you, he was making amends to me. He was taking the ninth step. But see, I didn't have a program, and I didn't have any steps, and I didn't know what he was doing, but it was different, and I liked it. And he began to tell me all of the things that he had done in his drinking days that he was sorry for. And then when he got it through, then he asked me, what else have I done? And I mean to tell you, I let him have it. I absolutely let him have it. And to my utter amazement, he wasn't hollering and I wasn't crying. And I realized later we were beginning to communicate for the first time. And then after he said, is that all? And I said, well, that's all I can think of. And he also told me the reasons that he did what he did. And when he explained where he was coming from, I could accept it. And I began to understand. And I didn't know this at the time, but there was a big weight that was just lifted from my shoulders. All of the resentments and all the anger and everything that I had about him was lifted. It was just gone. And then he began to tell me the things that I had done that he didn't like. And because he had set the tone for that meeting, I followed suit and I listened. And then that night I made the decision, yes, I would like to try again, because I knew that it was the first time that we had ever had a chance to make the marriage work, and I was willing to try. And I knew that with the program, the two meetings that I went to, I had some hope and some faith that he could be okay and our marriage could be okay. And our children could be okay. And that was the beginning of a real spiritual journey for me. Now, after I was not very swift in Al-Anon. We didn't have steps to work. We sat in the back room and we studied the big book, and we talked about the disease of alcoholism, and I learned a lot. But nobody ever said Al-Anons were sick, and nobody said Al-Anons needed to work steps. So I was very slow. But what I wanted was what the AAs had. And I wanted to be an alcoholic so bad I could hardly stand it. Because you alcoholics were the ones that were happy, joyous, and free. You had the fun. You loved life. And Al-Anons were just a bunch of sad sacks. Now, that's the way they were. And thank God, you know, we have grown, and we're not that way anymore. But they didn't have a program of recovery to live by. And I'm grateful that I have been in Al-Anon from its beginning, and I have watched Al-Anon grow and come of age, and I have watched Al-Anons work the steps, and I have watched Al-Anons see their defects of character. I got into some deep step study along the way, and I heard a man talk about untreated alcoholism, and if you were suffering from fear and self-pity and guilt, that you are suffering from untreated alcoholism. And I began to ask people, what is untreated Al-Anonism? Everything I heard, I learned to turn it around and use it for me. And I asked people about untreated Al-Anonism, and nobody knew. Nobody could tell me. So I finally decided I was going to have to find out for myself, just like I had to find out about the principles of the program that we practice in all our affairs. Nobody could tell me. I had to read and search and find them for myself. And at the time I heard this man talk, we had just lost a daughter with cancer, and I was suffering from untreated Al-Anonism. And I was into self-pity, and I was into resentment, and I was into sloth, and I was just into a lot of negative things. And I began to look and see that my untreated Al-Anonism was the same as my defects of character that I found when I did my sixth step, that my untreated Al-Anonism were the things that I was powerless over in the first step. And that my untreated Al-Anonism were the things in the second step that I needed God to restore me to His harmony and order and peace and joy. So my untreated Al-Anonism was controlling my life. I have some lists here if you would like to know about my untreated Al-Anonism. And this is I made a new list because I've just been going through the steps again. Some of the things have been removed to a degree, and some have reared their ugly head again in another form and another guise. But my untreated Al-Anonism is intolerance, impatience, criticism, reacting rather than responding, playing God, believing I know best, sadness, low self-image, expectations, selfishness. I have another list on both pages here. Hurt feelings, lonely, fragile, frozen inside, false pride, being a martyr, blind spots, self-pity, complaining, blaming, fear, frustration, depression, people-pleasing, perfectionist. So you kind of get the idea that it took me a while to be able to see that there was really something the matter with me. I identified with the alcoholic so much that I had a period of time that I thought I must be an alcoholic that doesn't drink. And I finally got some real help with some people that knew, and I realized that no, I really wasn't. I had been drunk once on phenobarbital. I had been drunk on self-pity. I had been drunk on false pride. I had been drunk on resentments, and I had been drunk on a lot of things. But when the guy asked me Well, when Bob was a prisoner of war and you were and missing in action and you didn't know whether he was dead or alive, why didn't you go back to those little white pills? I said, well, I never thought about it. And he said, you are not an alcoholic. So I found out that you AAs didn't have any corner on God. And if I wanted what you had and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it, then I could get it too. So I got my big book and I made it mine and I got into the steps and I was able to find out about me. And I was able to have the same experiences with God and this program and experience the promises that the big book talks about being an Al-Anon. So my sponsors were AAs, and they're the ones that spoke to me, so they're the ones I chose. I didn't tell people I had sponsors because Al-Anons didn't have sponsors, but I had them. They were my teachers. And I learned from them, and then I turned around and I gave it to Al-Anon. And that's my story. It's different from most of yours. And thank God it's not that way anymore. But I couldn't have gotten it if I hadn't done it that way. Sometimes I would be the only woman in a group. And it was necessary for me to work with AA women and to sponsor some AA women. Back in those days, we did whatever we had to do to keep it going. And now, you know, there's all kind of rules and regulations, and that's wonderful. And I'm sure they're necessary. But my roots are in the big book, in the 12 and 12. I went to World Service and Al-Anon as the Al-Anon delegate from Texas years ago. And I went up there saying that Al-Anon needed a study book, a 12 and 12. Al-Anon needed a 24-hour book. Well, I got up there and they had that going. That's ODAD. But I talked to Alice Butler about Al-Anon needed literature to tell them how to get into the program at depth when they were ready, and we didn't have it. And she said, oh, we're too busy, we've got too many things piled up, too many things first to do, and there's not time for that. And I said, Alice, what do you want an Al-Anon to do when they're ready to work the program at depth? She said, well, just use the big book in the 12 and 12, that's what I do. And I said, thanks, that's what I've been doing for years, and I'll continue doing it. Now, I heard someplace that they're trying to say that the big book isn't conference-approved literature for Al-Anon. And I'm glad I wasn't around then. I'm glad that I got to use the big book and the 12 and 12 because it healed me at depth when I became willing to search and dig into it. And I've also heard that maybe they're going to reconsider and maybe they're going to let it be conference-approved. But I'm glad that each group is autonomous and our Lake Whitney group approves of Al-Anon's using the AA book in the 12 and 12. And I'm doing a step study right now at the Lake Whitney Al-Anon group, and that's what we're doing. And it works. And it's magic. You don't even have to like it. All you have to do is do it. It's not easy. But there are clear-cut directions. And I've seen too many people, including myself, that have done that. And the change happens at depth. Bob and I had a lot of fun in the program. We did a lot of things. We went a lot of places. We were a good team. Got a lot of things going. Young people's conferences at Lake Whitney. And the Lake Whitney Fantastic. And the Brazos Riverside Conference. And the Lake Brownwood Conference. A lot of things happened in our years together in the program. And we were each other's teachers. I learned from him and he learned from me. And when I needed to practice patience or tolerance, he would oblige me by giving me areas that I could work on. And whatever I needed to learn, if I needed to learn to quit fighting anything or anybody, he would oblige me by giving me situations for me to practice that. And when I would go off and do all of these things that he didn't understand or want me to do, then he had to do a little practicing too. So we learned how to live together as adults. One of the things that happened as we began to work with people in the program, we looked back and saw what happened to us when we put our cards on the table. We came clean. We were honest with each other. And we began to ask couples that were having trouble to write down all the things that they didn't like about the other one and come and meet with us and get it all out. The big book says that we clear away the wreckage of the past. And a marriage is part of our past. And it needs to be looked at. It needs to be cleared out. And if we hadn't done that, we would not have been able to have made it in the program. We could not have been happy if we hadn't have done that. So we did not have anyone as a referee with us. But most couples need referees when they are at outs with each other. Because if you have someone that sitting there that you admire and you trust, you're not going to yell and you're not going to cry as much, and it's going to be in more balance and it's going to be fair. So we ask people always to have your sponsor or another couple or someone that both of you were in agreement about and just get it out. Put it all out on the table. If we don't do that, we're not living in honesty. And dishonesty forfeits divine aid, and it is necessary to practice the principle of honesty in our marriage situation as well as in every other situation in our life. So that was a key for us that we used to work with others. We learned about unconditional love. We learned how to leave each other free. Bob had a hard time releasing me. Sometimes in Al-Anon, we talk about things, maybe certain things, more than AA's talk about it. And one of the things that I learned was to leave people free and release them with love to God. And I would say to Bob sometimes, why can't you just accept me like I am? You know, why are you still trying to change me? Why can't you just release me with love? And one day he said, you and your damn releasing. I don't even know what you're talking about. And I realize that until a person has done it, they don't know. So if they don't know, then you have to talk to them in their language. And he didn't understand my Al-Anon language sometimes. But something he did understand was, you got to get off my back. He understood that. And so we had to learn to communicate. We had to learn how to raise our children and how to leave them free. And when children come home after they're grown and you get to see some of their actions, you get another chance to practice your steps of the program at a greater degree. Because if you think you're powerless over them when they're little, you certainly are when they're grown. So we had many opportunities to live our program and practice it. One of the things I'd like to tell you about along the way was that, and this got me into the program at a greater depth. Bob was on a dry drunk, and he was not wanting me to go to meetings. He was not going to meetings, and he didn't understand what was the matter with me. This was before people knew Al-Anons were so sick. And he said, you're mixed up about who the alcoholic is in the family. Why do you want to go when I don't go? And by then, Al-Anon and AA, it was my life. It was my lifeblood, and I had to have it. And I had found answers for living that I needed all of my life. And this particular evening, he had two of his AA babies that came to see us, and we had gotten to the point that we couldn't talk anymore except through someone else. Have you ever been that way? When they came in, he said, I want to talk to you all about her. What do you think is the matter with her that she wants to keep on going to these meetings and do all this stuff when I don't want to go? And I see AAs all day, and my office is full of them, and I come home and I'm tired, and I just want to lay down on the couch and watch television. And what's the matter with her that she wants to go to meetings? And he got the Bible out, and he read in the Bible that a wife was to be subservient to her husband. And he used all the tricks, and I blew. I just, all my Al-Anon went out the window, and I ran to the back bedroom crying with just tears streaming down. But I knew that there was one that I could go to that would understand, and I went to God. And I got down on my knees that night, and I think I'd been in the program about 6 years at that time. And I've heard it said, if you don't get to the program on your knees, if you stay long enough, you'll get there. And I stayed long enough to get there. And I talked to God, and I admitted to God that I was powerless over Bob as a drinking alcoholic, but I had forgotten to admit to God that I was powerless over a sober alcoholic, and that my life was as unmanageable as it had ever been with him drinking. And then I began to look at the marriage and see what a mess it was in, and I really came to believe that night that God could restore our marriage. I did not know how, but I gave it to him, and I made a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of God, which I had been doing daily. But I had forgotten that Bob was part of my life, and I had forgotten to turn him over to God. I came into this program with the idea that I was responsible for him, and I needed to help him, and I needed to help get him fixed. And we would go on a trip, and I would take the big book in the car, and I would read it to him. Sometimes he would say, "Will you please quit reading that book?" And I tried to get him to church, and I tried to do all these little maneuvering things, and nothing was working. And I gave the whole thing to God that night. The marriage, Bob going to church. I had been reading all of these wonderful books that I had found, and he laid in bed and read the whodunits. And it was a mess. And I turned Bob over to God that night and said, "You can have him, just he's yours." And then I looked at the fourth step, and I had never done a total fourth step. I had just messed around with it, and I had never done a fifth step. And God let me know in no uncertain terms that night that until I was willing to go to any lengths to get this program, that I would have no more spiritual growth. It was time for me to turn my eyes inward and look at me. And I became willing to do that. And I really had a surrender at depth. Now, all the time all of this was going on, these three people were sitting in the den wondering, what's the matter with her? And I came in about an hour later, and I looked at them, and I looked at Bob, and I said, "I have made a decision." And he said, "Oh, you have. I didn't know you could make one." And that's the way I was. I didn't make decisions. Whatever he did, I did, and it was fine. Whatever he said, I did. And I said, "Yes." He said, "What is it?" I said, "I've decided to turn you over to God." And you know, he fidgeted in his chair, and he said, "Now wait just a minute. I don't know whether I want you to do that or not." And I said, "Honey, it's too late. I've already done it. And I want you to know, if you don't want to go to church with us, that's just okay. If you want to lay up in bed and read your whodunits for the rest of your life, that's okay too. I love you just like you are, and I'm grateful you're sober and you're free." And in me releasing him and giving him his freedom, I got mine. And then that gave God an opportunity to come in and change him. And that's what happened. And then it just got better, and it got better. Another commitment that I made along the way was that I would listen. I would practice that 11th step. By the way, I did do my steps. I did do a fifth step and a sixth and a seventh and on through, and have done them many, many times. Maybe a couple of times a year, I go completely through the steps again. But that was my real beginning there. And after that, I loved God so much. I loved my life so much. And I loved what was happening so much that I couldn't do enough. And I said, "God, I want to do your will more than anything else. And in your will is my peace, my joy, and my happiness, and I know it." And so I made a commitment to God that every day I would listen. And I would listen to that still small voice. And I would follow it. And I would do what I felt God's will for me was. And I began to do that. And wonderful things began to happen. Not things particularly for me, per se, but for what I call making a contribution to life began to happen. I would listen, and I would act on it, and I would do it. Now, I don't tell new people this because they might hear different voices, but we need to be in the program a while, and we need to develop the ability to spiritually discern what is from God and what is not. And I was at that place, and I have followed that. And I made a commitment I would do that and let the chips fall where they may. And chips have been falling ever since. And I'm sure the chips will continue to fall. But I have never regretted for one moment that commitment. And it was necessary for me to distinguish between what I call my high self, which is in tune with God, and my lower self, which had been running my life. And I would sit in meditation, and I would know it just seemed so right for me to do this. And then I would come out of meditation from my high place and into this world, and I'd hear another voice. And it would say things, oh, you can't do that. What will they say? What will they think? They're not going to like that. And because I had made the commitment, I followed through. And there's a lot of things that have happened because I made that commitment. The Texas Alateen Conference got started because of that. There's some couples meetings that got started. There's the woman-to-woman conference. There's just lots of things that have come about as a result, young people's at Lake Whitney. Many things have come about as a result of me making that commitment. When I talk to people today about this, I say, if you don't want your life to change, don't do it, because your life will change. And I suggest that if you want to do that, to make that commitment to yourself and God and another person. I find out that if I make a commitment to myself and God and another person, I am more likely to keep it. That person helps keep me in line. So I believe that is a better way to do it than the way I did it. I just kind of mumbled along, and I just kind of did things. There wasn't anybody telling me to do these things. It just seemed to be what happened to me inside. After 29 and a half years of sobriety in the program, Bob White made his transition to the big meeting. He had about 3 months of illness. And he had many, many people that came and loved him and stood with him, supported him, and me too. And there was a lot of healing that went on for a lot of people during that time, for him, for me. And one of the things that that I had had problems with was that Bob had, the ones he loved the most were the ones he was most critical of. And he wanted me to be perfect. And he wanted his girls to be perfect. And, you know, we just couldn't measure up. We never could quite make it. And, you know what, I finally just quit trying and just started being me and had some real freedom. But he had problems with us sometimes, and he would be critical. And if I could say there was a wedge in our relationship, I would say that was, for me, that was what it was. And that I can say that for our twin daughters, too. And, you know, God just removed that from him. When he got ill, that was removed. And he really just was so grateful to me, and he loved me for free, and he accepted me like I was. And one day I said, honey, I am so grateful you are giving us the blessing. And I said, you're just so kind, and you're appreciative. He says, how could I be any other way? You are so wonderful. That's what I wanted all my life. I just wanted him to love me and just think I was wonderful just like I was. And that, God removed that from him. So that he had been able to do are a result of me being willing to go to any length to get this program and make it mine. I took a step or a slogan or a principle. I would take one thing and I would live it and apply it and practice it for 1 month. And that's the way I made it mine. And I had to work as hard as any alcoholic has ever worked to do this. It doesn't matter how long it takes, and it doesn't matter how hard you have to work. The main thing is that it happens to you, and nobody can do it for you. Along the way, of maybe 10 years ago, I heard a man, a wise man, talk about the blessing. And it was not an AA Al-Anon retreat. But I was there with one of my AA sponsors. And this man was a minister and a teacher. And he counseled many people. And he said the first question that he always asked anyone when they came to him for counseling, were you a blessed child? He said people don't even know whether they're blessed or not. And Scripture, he explained, and Scripture says that it's our birthright to be blessed by our parents. If we are not blessed by our parents, we go out into life an emotional cripple. And we look for the blessing in sex, in alcohol, in drugs, in cars, in houses, in clothes. We look for it out here. Something to make us feel good inside. This man went on to say that if you were not a blessed child, remember that it's not that your parents would not give you the blessing, it's that they could not. A person cannot give away what they haven't received. And I began to look at my life and realize that I was not a blessed child. My father being an alcoholic, my mother being very concerned about his drinking and what was going to happen, and she was from the old school too, that you don't ever tell anybody what they are doing right. You just tell them what they're doing wrong. So it didn't matter what I did, it should have been better. And I lived 50 years of my life that way, not knowing any different. If I made up my bed and I had room check with my mother, well, I should have done this and I should have done this. If I made a B+ on my report card, it should have been an A. I looked at Bob's life, and he never received the blessing either. And here two young people get together and want the blessing from each other, and you can't give away what you haven't received. So not only did we have alcoholism, but we couldn't give each other what we really needed, was the blessing. This man also said, if you don't get the blessing from your parents, quit going back to the dry hole. It can ruin your life. And he says, you have the blessing from God, and that's what you need. And I looked at my life in the program and realized I never felt I had the blessing till I got here. And I looked at all the people that I knew and realized there were not too many of them that I knew that got the blessing at home. If you did, you were certainly more emotionally mature and more able to handle life. I know some people that have had it, and it's wonderful and it's healing. But if not, you get it here. You get it in AA, you get it in Al-Anon. He explained that if your parents blessed you, it's that they loved you and accepted you just like you were. You did not have to do anything to earn their favor. Yes, you would get corrected, and it didn't matter about whether you had material things or not. It's the feeling that you had with your parents, that you could go to them and talk to them about any problem that you had, and they would listen, and they would understand, and they would work with you. They would hear you. And that makes us have some emotional stability when we get that. That's the reason we get emotional stability in the program. We get the blessing from each other. I've never seen any place on this earth that people give the blessing better than you do in AA and Al-Anon. And that's the attraction of the program. That's what keeps us coming back for more. That's the reason we go to a meeting when we're tired and worn out, and we leave and we're all pumped up and we're feeling great, because we got the blessing one more time. So the neat thing is that we do that for each other. And that's the real attraction of the program. And we don't even know what we're doing. It's just the way we do it. But I've never been more grateful in my life for Al-Anon and AA than when I listened to this man talk. And everything he said, I said, I've done that. I've done that. That's the way I'm living my life. I had learned to give my parents the blessing, and my children, and my husband. And we learned to give it to each other. And for me, it was necessary for me to get it from you, and then I could accept it from God and accept God's forgiveness and forgive myself. And when that happens to us, then we can give it out to others. Wherever we are, whoever we are, we can give the blessing to each other. So I want to ask you to ask yourself the question. Look at your life, look at your family, and ask yourself, are you blessing your family and your friends, or are you still possessing? It's easier to give each other the blessing in meetings than it is to give our family the blessing. My life has changed a lot. That daughter that looked up at me with tears in her eyes when she was 8 years old is now a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That husband that was going to divorce her and was in such a mess he never wanted to see her again is now a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Their lives have made a complete turnaround. Some people say they're the damnedest miracle that ever happened at Lake Whitney. And it's just wonderful to have, to still have a family together in the program. After Bob had been gone about 8 or 9 months, I decided I didn't know how to be single. I didn't know how to do single. And I decided I wanted to be married. That I didn't, I'd been married all my life. And all my friends were married, and I didn't know who or anything. But I decided, I believe I had rather, I want to stay in the program. And I don't believe an ordinary earth person would understand me taking off and going to Nashville for a few days and going around the country. And I best marry someone in the program. And I thought I married an Al-Anon. And unbeknownst to me, I married another alcoholic. So that's the way life is. And it was not my plan to have a brand new baby alcoholic in my life. I thought that I had had enough. You know, I had a bunch of them. I had a lot of ex-son-in-laws, as well as a present son-in-law and a daughter and a husband and a father and a brother-in-law. And I've been surrounded. And I know that that's been necessary for me. And I'm at peace with that. And my plans never have worked out too well anyway. But God's plan always does. And I am comfortable living my life in God's plan, in His will, knowing that as long as I do that, as long as I stay awake and don't go to sleep, as long as I can practice these principles in my affairs to the best of my ability, that whatever I need to walk through, it's okay. This new husband of mine, I was his sponsor in Al-Anon for 24 years. And I said if I had known I was going to marry him, I would have done a better job. I moved off and left him in Midland, and I went to Lake Whitney, and I didn't teach him too well. So he's having, but I had to resign as his sponsor. And he has had, he's been ill for 1 year. And that is when some of my character defects begin to rear their ugly head, and things that I thought were gone from my life, I found out that my three main defects of character today are still impatience, intolerance, and criticism. And I thought they were gone, and they were until this happened. So God gives me another test. Now, I won't say God does it, because that doesn't go well with me. What I say is, life gives me another test. We come into this life to have experiences and learn our lessons. And I thought I had learned that lesson real good. And apparently I had not learned it well enough. And so it was necessary for me to have another test. And I am aware that anything that happens to me, it's necessary for me to say, Father, what is my lesson in this? So I'm learning my lessons. And I'm having another test. And through the fellowship and the love of you people in this program and the grace of God, I continue to walk through my tests. And I love life. And I love every one of you. And I give you the blessing. God bless you.